Okay, good afternoon.
Good morning.
Last week I made the opposite mistake. It was 12:05 and I said good morning. So good afternoon. Good morning at 12, whatever. There was a typo. I don't know if anyone noticed, but there was a typo on the schedule that Matan printed out with the title of this shiur. If you look at the schedule that they printed out for the summer program, it says that I'm giving a shiur this morning at this time. And the title they wrote on there was, how did Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai make the right decision? Now, if you look at this sheet here, the title I actually sent in was, did Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai make the same decision? Right. But the issue is, what's significant to me, you know, I sent in the title. Shuli Mishkin actually sent in the title. I sent in the title, and at some point after that, they printed up the schedule. And I was here one day, and I picked up the schedule, and I looked at it, and I chuckled. Because it's not a big deal, but it was very insightful to me that whoever typed that up, whether consciously or subconsciously, I'm not sure, but assumed that the answer to the question that I actually asked, which is, did Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai make the decision, has to clearly be yes, can't possibly even be a question, and therefore I must have meant, how did he make the right decision? But actually, as we'll see, it's not at all clear that he made the right decision. I haven't yet discussed what the decision was. We'll get to that. But we'll see that he made a very significant decision. And it was a very significant debate about whether he made the right decision or not. A debate that continued for generations. And we'll see that I'm not even sure that he was certain that he made the right decision. So we have to talk about this decision. Before getting to that decision, a word or two about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai and a very intriguing description that we have in the Talmud about his deathbed scene, the end of his life. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was the head of the Sanhedrin in the first century of the Common Era, both before and after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. And according to tradition, he lived to a very old age, according to one source, till the age of 120. And the Talmud in Masechet Brachot, he's also credited with being the one who, and we'll talk more about this in a few moments, the one who helped lead the Jewish people through the extraordinary trauma of the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, a trauma that in many ways was worse, perhaps, than the trauma of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, for a number of reasons, and not only helped lead his generation through that trauma, but one of the reasons why the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash was so much more devastating in some ways than the destruction of the first is that it began an exile that was much, much longer, not a 70-year exile, but an exile that's almost 2,000 years in existence and is not yet over. An exile that involved not just exiling the Jews from the land and moving them to another country, as took place after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, but then involved a dispersion and a diaspora and a scattering of the Jewish people literally to every corner of the earth, and an exile that involved terrible, terrible tragedies and sufferings, what we call Jewish history, basically, from that point forward. And Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is credited with having done a number of things. Maybe some of the other shiurim are going to touch on this or already have, I don't know, to sort of prepare the Jewish people for that and to make the modifications necessary, even within the system of halakha, to enable us to exist without a Beit HaMikdash, without a temple. This is the great Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. And the Gemara, the Talmud of Masechet Brachot, the first source on the sheet, tells the following story about his death at the end of his life. The Gemara tells us, Kishechala Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, nichnesu tamidav levakro. He was a 120-year-old man. He was on his deathbed. It was very clear that he was approaching the end. And his students came to visit him. Kivan shera'a otam itchil levkot. When he saw them, he began to cry. Amru lo tamidav, Mer Yisrael, amud ha'imini, patisha chazak. Mipnei ma ata bocheh. They referred to him with all sorts of laudatory expressions, and they said, Lamp of Israel, pillar of the right hand, mighty hammer. I mean, the English translation I put there, Why are you crying? Amai lehem. He said, I'll tell you why I'm crying. Ilu lifnei melech basar badam hayu molichin oti. Shehayom kan umachar bakever. Shim koes alai, ein kaaso kaas olam. Vim osrani, ein isuro isur olam. Vim mitani, ein mitato mitat olam. Vani achol lefaiso bedvarim v'lshachto bedmamon. I'll read the rest of the sentence and then translate. V'achshav shmolichim oti lifnei melech malchei malchim hakadosh baruch hu. Shuchai v'kayam li'olam li'olmei olamim. Sh'im ko'es alai ka'aso ka'as olam. V'im osrani isuro isur olam. V'im imitani mitato mitat olam. Ve'eini achol lefaiso bedvarim v'lo l'shachto b'mamon. V'lo od. Ela sh'yesh lefanai shnei drachim. Achat shel gan Eden ve'achat shel gehinom. Ve'eini yodeh ve'ezo molichin oti. Ve'lo evkeh. He said to his students, you're asking me why I'm crying? I'm about to pass from this world. I'm about to face heavenly judgment. If I was about to be brought before an earthly king, a human king, a king who is going to judge me, but that king is alive today and will be dead tomorrow. And if he gets angry at me, his anger is not eternal. It's only temporary. And if he puts me in jail, if he imprisons me, it's not forever. It's only for the temporal life of this world. And even if he kills me, it's not eternal death because there'll be a resurrection eventually. And not only that, I might be able to talk him out of it. I might be able to bribe him with money even. And even so, I would be crying of fear. How much more so now that they're bringing me before Melech Malchei Amlechin, the Almighty King of Kings, who lives forever. And if he imprisons me, I'll be in prison for eternity. And if he chooses to kill me, I'll be dead for eternity. And I can't convince him and I cannot bribe him. And not only that, but I see in front of me two roads. One which leads to Gan Eden, to heaven, and one which leads to Gehinom. And I don't know which road they're taking me down. And you're asking me why I'm crying? This is what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was thinking on his deathbed. The Gemara then continues. His students didn't respond to that directly. Amru Rabbeinu Barchenu. They said, Rebbe, teacher, before you go, give us a blessing. Give us some words of strength. Some parting words. Amar lehem, Yehi ratzon, shetehei mora shamayim aleichem, kemora basar vadam. May it be God's will. I give you a blessing that you should fear God as much as you fear people. As you fear people, so should you fear God. That's a little bit surprising. And the students were surprised. Assumedly, one should fear God much more than one fears people. And they said to him, Amrulo Tamidab, Ad Khan, that's it? We should only fear God as much as we fear people? Amar lehem ulevai. He said to him, Halavai. Obviously, in principle, you should fear God much more than you fear people. But you know what? If you manage to fear God as much as you fear people, Dayenu, that's enough. And if you're surprised by such a statement, he says, look, Teidu, Kisha Adam Over Avera, Omer Shalo Yirani Adam. He says, people are willing to do all sorts of things that are violations of God's laws, whether Ben Adam La Chavero, whether crimes committed against other people or crimes committed against God. They're willing to do many things wrong as long as nobody sees them. If someone sees them, that will be a deterrent. But God always sees. So you know what? We don't fear God as much as we fear people. If you can manage to fear God as much as you fear people, halavai. And now, with those words, Rabban Yochanan realized that he was reaching the end, literally. And according to the Gemara, these were his last words. B'sha'at p'tirato amar leh. Panu kelim mipnei hatum'ah v'hechinu kisei l'chizkiyahu melech Yehuda sheba. He told them two things, his last words, and with those words he died. First of all, panu kelim mipnei hatum'ah. That's a halachic statement. He realized that he was about to die, and the halacha is that if a person dies, any objects, vessels that are in the house will become tameh, will become impure, they have to be purified, some of them would no longer be able to be used. In those days, they observed those laws, which unfortunately we don't really observe right now, we cannot really observe. So he told him, there's going to be a dead body in here soon. Please remove everything from the house. And that's also a way of signaling to them that this is it. And he said one last thing. V'hechinu kiseh l'chizkiyahu melech Yehuda sheba. Bring in a chair, because an important visitor is coming here at this moment to greet me and to escort me on my journey. And that visitor is Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda, the King Chizkiyahu, who ruled in Yerushalayim some 750 years or even a little bit more prior to the days of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Chizkiyahu HaMelech is coming to escort me on my journey. Give him a chair. We have to. And those were Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's final words, according to this Gemara. The Gemara raises a number of questions. There's really three parts to the story, right? The first part where he explains why he's crying. His students were surprised because he apparently was very worried. He's not sure if he's going to be, he's about to face heavenly judgment, and he's not sure if he's going to be successful in that judgment. He's not sure which of the two roads they're taking him down. His students undoubtedly had no doubt whatsoever, and they were perhaps surprised that he was concerned even. How could someone so great be worried? And perhaps that can simply be understood that is the sign of a great person, that he's worried, that he's much more critical of himself than others are of him. So, if that's all we had here, the second statement as well, you know, fear God as much as you fear people. Also, it's a surprising statement, it's an interesting statement. But the last line, Hechinu kisei l'chizkiyahu melech Yehuda sheba, that line requires explanation. He sees a vision, or he has the sense that, and perhaps that line can be seen as sort of a resolution, right? If Chizkiyahu melech Yehuda is coming to escort him, so probably he's going down the good road. But why Chizkiyahu? I mean, Chizkiyahu HaMelech was a great man. But there were many great people who lived before his time. I mean, him kvar. Maybe Moshe Rabbeinu should come, or Aaron HaKohen, or maybe the Avot, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Some of the commentaries try to wrestle with this, and some of them connect it to events early in Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's life, that he served in the position of the Sanhedrin, and the leaders of the Sanhedrin were generally descendants of the Davidic dynasty, and he himself was not, and he wanted to show that, in spite of that fact, that one of the representatives of the Davidic dynasty was coming to greet him, but still, there were several dozen kings from the Davidic. Why Chizkiyahu? Why not David himself? Or Shlomo? What does this mean? I'm sorry? He did. He repented, that's true. But still, he's not the only example of someone who repented. So, I'd like to come back to this in a few moments. And share with you an interpretation that I heard a number of years ago that blew me away. And once I heard it, I was certain it's the correct interpretation, even though it's from a modern scholar of Herzog, who, you know, from two generations ago, and not one of the Achronim or the Rishonim that discussed this. But I'm certain that it's the correct approach. We'll get to that. But before we're going to get to that, we have to read another story from a different passage in the Gemara about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, the story in which he made that decision to which we referred. And before getting to that, I need to give you a little background. I mentioned already that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai presided over the Jewish people before and after, and thus also during, the destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash. The destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash was the culmination, not the end actually, the climax. I wouldn't say the culmination, the climax of a terrible war between the Jews and the Romans, a war that lasted in total, almost 7 years, which I imagine you're discussing in other contexts here, or has any of the other shiurim discussed the history? Okay, so a brief historical overview. Okay, most of what we know from that period, other than the sources in the Talmud, and the sources in the Talmud, you have to read them very carefully because it's not clear exactly always which information is actually historical and which information is poetic, agadic in nature, midrashic, and not meant as actual historical data. But the primary source, not the only, but the primary source of information we have about those events is the writings of Josephus Flavius, Yosef ben Matityahu, who was a Jew, a Kohen actually, and was a general in the war against the Romans, who suffered a crushing defeat at the hands of the Romans, and in order to save his own life, he basically surrendered to the Romans, and some would call him a traitor, some would call him a deserter, some would call him a peace activist. He went over to the Roman side and began to work for the Romans, with the Romans, in propaganda effort, trying to convince the Jews to stop the rebellion. And afterwards, he wrote a number of extremely important works of history. The most important one, which is called the War of the Jews Against the Romans, or sometimes it's translated as the Jewish War, which is a very, very detailed account of the events of this period, of this war. There's a significant debate about exactly how accurate his information is, especially because some of the things he discussed involved himself and his own role, and he had certain very specific interests in mind. So some of what he says on certain issues, at least, need to be taken with a certain amount of, certain number of grains of salt. But the most accurate information we have, and in general, he's viewed to be fairly accurate. So with that, I will summarize the events leading up to the time period discussed in this Talmudic passage we're about to read. The temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era. The war began 4 years prior to that, in the year 66. The war began in the rebellion. Right, the land of Israel had been ruled by as a province in the Roman Empire already for at this point over 120 years, and for the past 40 years or so. No, I'm exaggerating. Well, except for a very brief period of 2 or 3 years, for almost 60 years, the land had been ruled not even by a Jewish king, but by a governor appointed by Rome, and the rebellion broke out in Caesarea in the year 66, and quickly spread to other places. It quickly spread to Masada, where a group of Jewish fighters captured the fortress of Masada and took it over, made a base of it, and also to Yerushalayim. And the Roman forces tried to put down the rebellion, and the Jewish fighters had some initial successes, and to some it probably seemed like a replay of the rebellion of the Maccabees, which had been at this point a few hundred years earlier, right? Where a group of dedicated Jewish fighters stood up to a mighty empire and managed to gain independence. And just as in Yehuda Maccabee's first battles, the local, in that point, it was the local Greek forces, here it was the Roman forces, were not prepared or were not capable of putting down the rebellion. And the Jews managed to gain some successes, and they took over some important posts in Yerushalayim and in other places, and they defeated the local Roman forces and killed some Roman soldiers. And that gave them some encouragement. Then, just like had happened in the time of the Maccabees, the Roman Empire realized we have a problem on our hands, and they came back a year or so later with a much more significant force pulled from other parts of the empire. Tragically, though, this is where the comparison between the revolt of the Maccabees and the revolt of what's called the Great Revolt ends. Because unlike in those battles where Yehuda Maccabee scored additional incredible victories against very, very powerful Hellenistic forces, that was not the case here. And when the Romans came back, the Roman Empire, after one small attempt, they realized that they need to send they sent Vespasian, who was one of the top generals in the Roman army, and they sent in several major legions of the Roman army, and Vespasian came to the land of Israel in the year 67 with a determined, very, very methodic military plan to put this rebellion to an end. And he did it methodically and very, very intelligent. He started in the Galil. The goal was to get to Yerushalayim last, after putting out all other flames of resistance, then to come to Yerushalayim. They knew that Yerushalayim was the heart of the rebellion. They knew that it was a very well fortified city by that point, and they were going to deal with Yerushalayim last. They started in the Galil, and they went systematically through the Galil. And basically, Jewish towns had two choices. You can either accept Roman rule and surrender, or don't call it surrender. You can make peace. You can openly accept the rule of the Romans and make clear that you're not part of the rebellion, or you'll be destroyed. And that's exactly what happened. Those towns that rebelled or that tried to fight the Romans, like Yodfat, where Josephus was, and like Gamla, and like Magdala, these towns, like Gush Chalav, these towns were destroyed. Gush Chalav, a little different. These towns were destroyed. Towns like Tzipori that opened their gates to the Romans were spared and even rewarded. And within first they started in the Galil, then they moved down the coastline and Eder Hayarden. And by the year, and then there was a slight delay because the Roman emperor died and Vespasian had to go back to Rome and he appointed his son Titus to finish the job. By the year 69, the Romans came to lay siege on Yerushalayim after, other than some tiny pockets, including Masada and a few other fortresses, basically the entire country was firmly under their control. They came to Yerushalayim. By the time they came to Yerushalayim, though, Yerushalayim had become a center of the revolt, and various groups that had been defeated elsewhere converged in Yerushalayim. Any Jewish fighters that were left to fight, by the time the Romans came to Yerushalayim, they were all in Yerushalayim. And Josephus, and this is extremely important for the Gemara we're about to read, Josephus describes the struggles that were going on in Yerushalayim at that time. The Jewish people was not united. And there were factions that didn't want, just like in the Galil, there were factions that thought the revolt was a mistake, either that never supported it in the first place, or maybe had supported it at an early stage, but realized that it's not going to work, and better to cut our losses, and better to surrender to the Romans, and to lower our heads, and to hope for the best. And there were others who wanted to fight. And Josephus describes a situation where in Yerushalayim there were, as the Roman siege was approaching, and after the siege had been laid, there were very, very significant debates that weren't only debates, that turned into violent struggles. And basically where the group known as the Zealots, or the Kanaim, those who were in favor of fighting, those who wanted to wear the mantle of the Maccabees and continue the war and believe that they could be victorious, they prevailed over the moderate factions, the ones that wanted to cut some kind of a deal or arrange some kind of truce. They prevailed over them through violent means, basically suppress them by intimidating them, by killing many of them and killing some of their leaders. And not only that, but by the time the Roman siege was laid to Yerushalayim, according to Josephus, not only were the fanatical extremists in control of Yerushalayim, but there was more than one group of such extremists, and they fought also with each other. There was one group, there had been several groups, but by the time the siege was laid on Yerushalayim, there were only two left, because others had been intimidated or accommodated into the other groups. There was one group, under the leadership of Yochanan Migush Chalav, who controlled the Harabayit. They made that their base. And there was a different group under the command of Shimon Bar Giora, who controlled the upper city, what's today known as the Jewish Quarter, and a little piece of the Muslim Quarter. And there were battles going on inside Yerushalayim. They were shooting at each other with arrows, and they had guard posts between the two. You couldn't travel between the two parts of the city. There were battles going on inside Yerushalayim, and the Romans knew this. And the Romans even encouraged it. The Romans even allowed it. They figured, the Jews are doing our job for us. It's on the background of that scene that the Talmud of Masechet Gittin tells the following story. Second source on the page. Again, I don't know exactly. There's definitely some historical data in here, as you'll see. Some of what I told you, you'll see in here. I don't know exactly which aspects of this story are meant to be historically accurate and which aspects perhaps are poetic or midrashic in nature. But in any case, this story tells us about the decision that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai made. Shadre yilavayu l'aspianus kesar. Aspianus kesar Vespasian, at this point the military general, came to Yerushalayim. Ata tsar ala tlat shani. He came and laid a siege that lasted ultimately for 3 years, or almost more than 2 years. Habu ba hanhu tlata atire. There were in Yerushalayim, there was a siege. Yerushalayim was an extremely well-fortified city. There were walls, there were towers, there was significant tens of thousands of very, very motivated Jewish fighters in the city. They had weapons, they had ammunition, they had even catapults and significant equipment. And the Romans chose, instead of trying a frontal assault on the city, the Romans' plan was simply to lay siege to the city and wait for the people to starve, wait for them to kill each other, just wait for the city to be weakened in that way. Havu Buhu Hanu Tlata Atiwi, there were three very wealthy men in Yerushalayim at the time. Nachtimon ben Gurion, Uven Kalba Savua, Uven Tzitzit HaKeset. Those were their names, and the Gemara tells us a little drasha about each one of them, why they were named at what they were. Ben Kalba Savua may be familiar to us because he was the father-in-law of Rabbi Akiva as well, or perhaps it was a later generation of his family, maybe his son or grandson who had the same name. In any case, these three people were extremely wealthy. I'll skip a few lines to the fourth line. And these three people said, we're going to take upon ourselves the responsibility of managing the siege and providing for the people in Yerushalayim to withstand the siege. Chadamar, Ana Zainulhu Bechiti Visare. One said, I can provide the entire city with wheat and barley, basic food, you know, basic grain. The Chadamar Luhu Bidechamro Bidemalcho Bemishcha. And second one said, I can provide them with wine and salt and oil. The Chadamar Bidetzivi. And one said, I can provide them with wood, because if you don't have wood to make fires, you can't cook any of those other things. And with our supplies, we'll be able to provide rations, and people will be able to withstand the siege. And we'll skip one line there to the next line. Habulu lemezan etzvim mechad shata. According to the Talmud, again, I don't know whether this is exactly accurate or whether this is some sort of an exaggeration, but the Talmud says there was enough supplies in the warehouses owned by these three wealthy people to provide rations for 21 years. In other words, they had supplies, and basically they wanted to wait out the siege. Havu buhu hanu biryone. But there were biryonim. Biryonim is a Hebrew word, or in this case Aramaic word, for thugs, ruffians, criminals, the ones that Josephus calls the zealots, or they call themselves that. Josephus has other words for them also, are referred to here in the Talmud as biryonim. Amruluhu Rabbanan, and the rabbis here, according to this description, are associated with the so-called moderate faction, although there were at least some of the sages mentioned in the Gemara that at least at the early stages agreed with the zealots. But the Gemara says here, Amruluhu Rabbanan, Nepuk v'naved shlama behadayu. Let's go out and negotiate with Vespasian. Let's negotiate some kind of a surrender, some kind of a treaty, some kind of a truce, some kind of an arrangement. Let's engage in diplomacy. We're still some sort of a position of strength. The Romans are not attacking. They understand that to take the city by force, they're going to have to put a siege here. The siege could last, and we have supplies for 21 years. Let's negotiate. That's what the rabbi said to the biryonim, to the zealots. Lo shavkinu. The zealots refused to allow the rabbis to go out. They wanted to send a diplomatic delegation. They refused. They refused to allow them out of the city. They had guards at the gates. Amrulu. So the zealots said back to the rabbis, Nepuk v'navid kraba bahadayu. They said, you join us, and let's go out of the city, not to negotiate, but to fight. Join our army. One side is saying to the other, the rabbis, as they're described here, or the moderates, are saying, this is a hopeless case. We have we have three Roman legions outside. And they've already destroyed the rest of the country. It's hopeless. Let's negotiate. Let's save what we can. And you guys are preventing us from doing so. And the zealots said back, no, you guys are preventing us. We have to fight. And again, the history of the Maccabim was very important here. It had been just a few hundred years earlier. I'm sure somebody said, you know, if people like you had been around in the time of Yehudah Maccabi, where would we be now? Neither side was willing to budge. So they said, let's go out and we want to go out and negotiate. Lo shafkinu, they didn't let him. Amru lahem, they responded, Nepuk v'navid krava ba'dayu. They said, the zealot said, you join us and let's go fight. Amru lahu rabbanan lo mistaya milta, it's not going to work. And neither side was willing to give in to the other. So finally, the biryonim decided they had a solution, according to this Gemara. Kamu klanhu lehanhu amabre dechiti besare dehavachafna. So the zealots went and burnt the supplies of food in the wealthy people's warehouses, in order to create a famine in the city, so they'd have no choice but to fight. And in fact, there was a famine, and I'm skipping now. The continuation of the Gemara here tells some very dramatic stories, which some well-known Gemaras, people read these often on Tisha B'Av, the stories about Marta Bat Baitus, if that name means anything to you, a woman, a very wealthy woman, who had been one of the wealthiest people in the city, and she was reduced to very, very degrading, picking for and through the garbage, looking for little scraps of food, and eventually she died. In any case, I'll skip that part and continue the following. Abba Sikra, Rosh Biryone de Yerushalayim, Bar Achte de Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai Hava. The head of the zealots, according to Gemara, was known as Abba Sikra. Abba Sikra is clearly a nickname. Sikari in Latin is knife or dagger. And the most extreme faction of the zealots walked around with knives and used them frequently, often against their own brethren, are known as Sikarikim in the Gemara. And the head of the group is called Abba Sikri. Abba Sikri. Abba Sikra. The head of them. So it's not clear which historic personage named by Josephus, if he is named by Josephus, this might be referring to. But in any case, he's described here as the head of the Biryonim. Again, according to Josephus, there was more than one head because there was more than one group. But someone important, the head of a certain group, Bar Achti de Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai Hava, he happened to be Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's nephew, his sister's son. And Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was also in Yerushalayim at the time. They're on the opposite sides of this debate, but he's his nephew. Shalach Leisa, Rabban Yochanan decides he's going to use his family connections here. And he sends a message to his nephew. Tabat Sina Ligabai. I want you to come and meet me in secret. I want to have a secret meeting with you. I can't do it publicly because we're on opposite sides here, but come meet your uncle. Ata, so he came. Amar Le. So Rabban Yochanan said to Abba Sikra, Ad Eimat Avditu Hachi. How much longer are you going to continue this? You're going to kill everyone by famine. You're going to destroy the nation. He tried to talk reason into his nephew. Amale, his nephew responded, Mayayavid, de'i amina lehumidi katluli. The leader of the zealot says, you think I'm the leader? If I try to say that to my people, they'll kill me. I can't control them. Amale, so Rabban Yochanan, so I can't do anything. Amale, Rabbi Yochanan said to him, Chazi li takanta le didi de epuk. He says, okay, fine, at least do this for me. I want you to help me get out of the city. I want to go talk to the Romans. And you guys, your people, that you say you can't control, have guards at the gates. Not to prevent the Romans from coming in, but to prevent me from coming out. I want you to get me out of the city. Figure out a way. That much you should be able to do for your uncle. Efsha dahave hatzala purta. Maybe if I can get out of the city safely and I can go talk to the Romans, I'm an important person. I'm the head of the Sanhedrin. I'll do the negotiations myself. Maybe I can still salvage something. So he says, okay, I'll tell you what to do. Fine, I'll help you, and here's what you have to do. Just listen to the extreme lengths that Abba Sikra told me he has to go in order to make this work. Amalei, nikod nafshika b'ktsiri. First you have to act like you're ill, which is common in the city under famine, right? I'm sure there was many diseases and epidemics. Act like you're ill. V'leite kuli arma v'lishai lulach. And have people come visit you and let the rumors get out that Rabban Yochanan is very, very sick. And then tell them you died. V'ayti midi saria v'agani gabach. And we'll put you in some kind of a coffin and put something very smelly, some kind of decaying animal in there so it should smell like there's a dead body in there. V'limu dinach nafshach. Tell them that you died. Let them say that you died. V'le'ayu bach talmidach. And let your students carry you. We're going to stage a funeral for you, right? But make sure that only your students are the ones carrying the coffin, because otherwise someone else might realize that you're not really dead when they're carrying you. So that way we'll smuggle you out to the bury Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. I'll be able to talk them into. Okay, so that's how we're going to do this. Avinachi. So he did that. And then when the time came to have this fake funeral, and Rabban Yochanan was lying in the coffin, alive and well and healthy, but They thought he was dead. Nichnas bo Rabbi Eliezer mitzarechev, Rabbi Yoshua mitzarecher, the pallbearers carrying the coffin were his close students. Himatu lepitcha, when they came to the gates and the guards were there, they said, look, we have to bury Rabbi Yocham and Zakkai. And halacha, you're not allowed to bury inside the city. You have to bury him outside the city. Ba'u lemidkire. They suspected something, and they wanted to stick spears through the coffin to make sure he was really dead. So which means the plan almost failed. Amar lehu, so Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, the two students, said to the Biryonim, don't do that. Yomru Rabbanan Rabban Dakru. They spoke their language to them. What will the Romans think of you when they see us burying Rabban Yochanan? They'll see that his coffin was mutilated. They'll say, look at these Jews who stabbed their rabbis. And Jewish pride, that got into them. So they said, okay, you're right, we can't do that. We don't want the Romans to think that of us. But they wanted to start pushing the coffin, shaking it really hard to make sure he's really, really dead. The Romans will find out you did that too. They'll say, just let us bury him with kavod. This worked. Patchulu lebava nafak. They opened the gate. He got out of the city. And he went straight to Vespasian. Got out of the coffin, went straight to Vespasian. This is before, I don't know exactly when this took place, but it's before Vespasian went back to Rome and appointed Titus to continue. He got there. Amar Shlama Alach Malka. He said, greetings to you, and he referred to Vespasian by the title King. I'll skip, there's a whole story here which I'll skip because I see the time starting to tick. But basically, Vespasian said to him, I'm not the king, how dare you call me the king? And it turns out that there had been a power struggle in Rome, and at that very moment, someone came and told Vespasian, you're the king, you know, you've just been appointed emperor. And he was very impressed, and he said, this is the key part now. Now we come to Rabban Yochanan's decision. I'll skip it. Five and a half lines from the bottom. No, I'm sorry. Three and a half lines from the bottom. Amarle, after the whole discussion, Vespasian said to him, Mezel azilna ve'inish achwina mishadrana. I just became emperor. I have to go back to Rome and be the emperor. I'm going to send someone else to finish the job against Yerushalayim. But before I go, I'm impressed with you, Rabban Yochanan. Ela bayi minai midi de'etein lach. Before I go ahead, make a request. What can I do for you? Amarle. So Rabban Yochanan said to him, he asked for three things. He made three requests. One, Tein li yavne v'chachameh. He says, I understand you're going to destroy Yerushalayim. I understand you're going to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. But already in the city of Yavne, west of here, out by the coast, we have a small center where a number of the rabbis have gathered, and Rabban Yochanan was planning to reestablish there, to move the Sanhedrin there, and to reestablish a center of Torah leadership, knowing that Yerushalayim would be destroyed in Yavne. I want you to spare Yavne. I want you to promise me you're not going to do anything to Yavne. Ten li Yavne v'chachameh, and the rabbis of Yavne, I want them spared. V'shoshalta de Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel, who had been the previous head of the Sanhedrin, whose son Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel had already been executed by the Romans. His descendants, I want you to spare them. They were descendants also of David HaMelech, and they were generally the heads of the Sanhedrin. I want you to spare them so we can have our Jewish leadership. The Asvat of the Messiah made Rabbi Tzadok, and I want a doctor to heal Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok was a very pious man who had fasted for 40 years already and was very, very ill. Fasted piously, hoping to prevent the destruction. And Rabban and Vespasian granted these three requests. Now, that's the end of that story, but there's a postscript added from a later generation. Kari Alei Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef, who lived generations later in Babylonia, one of the Amoraim, so some 300 or so years later, Rav Yosef made the following comment. The Itam, and some say it wasn't Rav Yosef, but Rabbi Akiva. If it's Rabbi Akiva, then we're talking about someone only two generations later who lived in Eretz Yisrael. So either Rav Yosef in Babylonia or Rabbi Akiva in Eretz Yisrael later on quoted the following pasuk about this event, about this incident. The pasuk is, Meshiv chachamim achor V'da'atam yisachel. Sometimes very wise people turn backwards and they stumble and their wisdom fails them. In other words, Rabban Yochanan made a crucial error, according to Rav Yosef or Rabbi Akiva. At that key moment, he did something wrong. He made a terrible mistake. Why? You have Vespasian there who says, what can I do for you? You just had a whole fight with the Biryonim. You said you wanted to negotiate. You should have said, spare Yerushalayim. Explain the situation. Tell them we want, there's significant numbers of us who want to do peace with you. It's those thugs inside. Let's spare the city, we'll help you. Negotiate. Ask for Yerushalayim. You didn't ask for Yerushalayim. You asked for Yavne v'chachameh. You got what you asked for. According to Rav Yosef, or Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva, by the way, who was a supporter of 60 years later, the next rebellion of Bar Kokhba, right? Who had a very different philosophy. And not all of the sages of his generation agree with him either. Whether we should fight the Romans. According to these people, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is guilty by error, not by intent, but bears responsibility for the destruction of Yerushalayim. He had the opportunity and he blew it. But why, in fact, did Rabban Yochanan not do that? Vehusa, because he thought, Dilma kulei hai lo avit, v'hatzala purta nami lo hai. He felt, if I ask for Yerushalayim, he may not agree. And then I'll wind up with nothing. I have to cut my losses and ask for Yavne v'chachamem. So did Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai make the right decision? According to whoever it is in the Matan office, clearly yes. According to Rav Yosef or Rabbi Akiva, no. And now I come to the Dvar Torah that I heard from quoted in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Herzog, who was chief rabbi, he had first chief rabbi of the State of Israel. I hope I'm allowed to say this. But I told you a minute ago, and I hope you'll agree when I share it with you now, it's clearly the Pshat. It's clearly what the Gemara meant. And maybe someone else said it before. I can't tell you. I've searched everywhere. But I did a certain amount of research, and I looked at everything I could get my hands on. All the commentaries that try to explain that cryptic line of Ten li yavne v'chachamea, I'm sorry, of Hechinu kisei v'chizkiyahu melech Yehuda, and I found a number of explanations, none of which was very convincing. This explanation, I'm convinced, is absolutely correct. And how is it possible that nobody thought of it until Rav Herzog? So here's what I hope I'm allowed to say. You have to live in Eretz Yisrael to see things this way. From the eyes of Galut, things just look different. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that or not, but why Chizkiyah? Rav Herzog pointed out the fundamental idea behind Rav Herzog's interpretation of the Gemara in Brachot, the first Gemara I read, is that when Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed, several decades later, after having done everything he did in Yavne, and after having done all that, he was still plagued by the fear that what later on Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Yosef said, did I do the right thing? And when he was sitting there and crying, there's two roads in front of me. One leads to Gan Eden and one leads to Gehinnom, and I don't know which one they're taking me on. It wasn't just plain old piety. He really was afraid. Because he felt the weight of responsibility. And it wasn't clear to him. Maybe I did the wrong thing. Maybe the destruction of Yerushalayim is on my shoulders personally. For decades, he was torn by this. At that crucial moment, did he do the right thing or the wrong thing? Why evoke the memory of Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda? Well, in the book of Melachim, in the Melachim, it's Melachim Bet. Perek Yud Chet and Yud Tet. I won't read the whole thing inside. But we learn about what was going on at the time of Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyahu ruled in Yehudah. At that time, the Jewish people were divided, as you know, into two kingdoms. The southern kingdom of Yehudah with its capital in Yerushalayim and a northern kingdom called Shomron. And there was a great enemy, a great empire, not the Roman Empire, a much earlier empire called Ashur, the Assyrians, who came and invaded the country several times. And first, they came and conquered Shomron, completely destroyed Shomron and the kingdom of Shomron, and took the 10 tribes of the kingdom of Shomron to exile. An exile from which they have not yet returned, if they ever will. Debate among the rabbis if they're ever coming back or not. But they haven't yet, at least. And then, a few years later, a different Assyrian general, after having destroyed the 10 tribes, came and invaded Yehudah. Sanherib came and invaded Yehudah. And he conquered most of the cities of Yehudah. The city of Lachish, for example, the second largest city of Yehudah, was destroyed and conquered. As were all the other cities of Yehudah. Azekah, a lot of them. And finally, Sanherib came to Yerushalayim and placed a siege on Yerushalayim. Sound familiar? This is exactly parallel to what the Romans had done in the time that Rabban Yochanan was in Yerushalayim. They conquered the rest of the country. In the case of the Romans, they started in the Galil. Actually, the Assyrians also started in the north. And then they conquered the rest. And by the time they came to Yerushalayim, everything else was in their hands. And all that was left was Yerushalayim. And by the way, just like in Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's time, Yerushalayim was filled not only with the local residents, but with refugees from all over the country. So was the case in Yerushalayim at the time of Chizkiyahu. I don't know, I need a Tehillim this summer going to Ir David. Is that part of the plan? No.
Well, it seems we have changed it again.
I see, okay. I'm sure many of you walked through Chizkiyahu's tunnel in Yerushalayim and have seen the wall in the Jewish quarter, the broad wall it's called, the Chomar Rechavah. Those are defenses that Chizkiyahu built in preparation for the coming Assyrian siege. He built a wall around the western hill of the city, which wasn't enclosed by a wall previously because the city had gotten much bigger because of all the refugees. He built a huge wall to protect the city. He dug this incredible tunnel to bring the water into the city. And the Navi here describes how the Assyrians came and placed a siege on the city. And they tried, using all sorts of psychological warfare techniques, they tried, in the time of Chizkiyahu, they tried to convince the people to surrender. And they said, I'm not going to read it inside because the time is short, but you can look at Malachim Bet, Perek Yud Chet, and Perek Yud Tet, chapter 18 and 19 of Malachim Bet, it's all there. The general, Rav Shakeh, the Assyrian general, came and started insulting the Jews and trying to convince them, if you surrender, you'll be spared, if you fight, you'll be killed, all sorts of terrible things. In other words, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai saw Chizkiyahu as a model. The situation that Chizkiyahu had been in some 750 plus years earlier, besieged in Yerushalayim by a huge army. According to the Tanakh, there were 185,000 Assyrian soldiers surrounding Yerushalayim, even more than the Roman legions that were surrounding Yerushalayim in Rabban Yochanan's time, having already conquered the entire rest of the country, representing a mighty empire that rules most of the world, threatening Yerushalayim and saying, surrender or you'll be destroyed. Exactly the situation that Rabban Yochanan was in. And what did Chizkiyahu do? Did he surrender? No. He withstood the siege, as was mentioned. He repented and prayed to God. And the prophet Yeshayahu, who was in Yerushalayim at the time, the great Isaiah, the prophet, came to Chizkiyahu with a prophecy directly from God. Yerushalayim will be spared, and miraculously there was a terrible epidemic or something, and the Assyrians, many of them died, and the siege was lifted, and they went back to Ashur, and Yerushalayim was spared. He simply waited it out. He simply had faith in God, refused to surrender, and Yerushalayim was spared. Essentially, Rabban Yochanan, for years, was tormented. Did I do the right thing or the wrong thing? And his final words were, Hechinu kisei l'chizkiyahu melech Yudah sheba. Chizkiyahu himself, not David, not Moshe, not Aaron, not Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Chizkiyahu, the one who could be presented as a model to criticize me and tell me you did the wrong thing. He personally is coming to escort me to Gan Eden because he understands that my situation is different than his. And according to this reading, the Gemara, Rabban Yochanan, who on his deathbed was still tormented and was crying out of fear that he made the wrong decision in his final moments, was confident that he did make the right decision. Chizkiyahu Melech Yudah himself is coming to escort me. Now, if this reading is correct, again, it's clear to me that that's Pshat in the Gemara. Why else Chizkiyahu? And the parallels, when you look at it from that angle, the parallels are so clear, and any other explanation just doesn't sound satisfactory at all. But the question is, if this reading is correct, how in fact was he so certain? If later on, others still criticized him, and if he himself may have been until the very final moment of his life, torn in anguish and unsure that he made the right decision, how is it possible that at that final moment, he, yes, was certain that he made the right decision? The Talmud of Masechet Yoma, which I did not put on the sheet, makes a statement that is fairly well known. Amar Rabban Yo, I'm reading the source here from the Gemara in Yoma, Daf Tet Amud Aleph, and continues to Tet Amud Bet, 9a, 9b. Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Turta mipnei ma charva shilo. The Gemara tries to figure out what was the reason for the various destructions, the various churbanot that befell the Jewish people. And even before the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, there was a previous, at least one previous destruction, where the Mishkan that stood in Shiloh for a few hundred years, right, until the time of the prophet Shmuel, the Mishkan of Shiloh was destroyed, the Aron was captured by the Philistines. Why did that tragedy take place? What sin, spiritually, what sin led to that tragedy? Mivnei shayu ba shnei dvarim giluy arayot bizayon kodshi. Because the sons of Eli, the priest who ruled in Shiloh, and this—they're basically just reading what the book of Shmuel tells us, Shmuel Aleph, about this event. They were guilty of committing adultery, and they were also guilty of not treating the sacrifices properly. Those were their sins, and that's why Shiloh was destroyed. Okay, so then the Gemara says, okay, Mikdash Rishon, mitnei macharei, and why was the first Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Where it wasn't necessarily those particular sins. Mishdash Rishon was because of three things. Avodah Zarah, Giluy Arayot, and Shvichut Damim. There was idolatry, rampant idolatry among the people. There was other forms of sexual immorality, and there was murder. And the Talmud brings proofs for each of these three things. So we understand why Shiloh was destroyed. And we understand why the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Major sins. Aval Mikdash Sheni. But how come the second Beit HaMikdash, where they weren't guilty of these sins, where there was many people who were studying Torah and were very meticulous in their religious observance, why was the second temple destroyed? And the Gemara gives a very well-known answer. There was baseless hatred. Lilamedcha sheshkula sinat chinam keneged shalosh averot avodah zarah giluy areot vishpichut damim. To show you that baseless hatred is worse, or is at least as bad as those three cardinal sins. Now this is quoted many, many times, but if you want to understand what the Gemara means, you have to read Josephus. Josephus himself says that the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. He says it differently. I'm reading you here a passage from the Jewish War, that same book, that describes a slightly earlier period. When the Zealots, before the siege of Yerushalayim, when the Zealots were trying to gain control of the city, there were some, according to Josephus, there were two Kohanim in the city that were leaders of the moderate faction. One was named Hanan ben Hanan, who had been perhaps the Kohen Gadol, and the other was Yehoshua ben Gamla, who's mentioned in the Talmud as well. And they were the leaders of the moderate faction trying to convince the people to not fight the Romans. And there's a whole story there, what happened, but in the context of a battle in the city, a particular faction of the Zealots, together with some non-Jewish allies that they brought into the city, killed these two Kohanim, Hanan ben Chanan and Yoshua ben Gamla. And Josephus writes, the priests, Hanan ben Chanan and Yoshua ben Gamla, who opposed the Zealots, were soon caught and killed. And the murderers, standing on their dead bodies, ridiculed Hanan for his devotion to the people, and Yoshua for his speech from the wall. He had given a speech trying to sway the people. So devoid of decency were they that they threw out the dead bodies without burial, so he claims. Not only did they execute these two great leaders, but they just dumped them off over the wall without even burying them. And then he says, I should not be far wrong if I said that the fall of the city began with Hanan's death, and that the overthrow of the wall and the destruction of the Jewish state dated from the day when they saw the high priest and champion of their cause assassinated in the middle of the city. That's what Chazal meant when they said the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed by Sinat Chinam. It's not only a spiritual statement, it's also a historical statement. And the Romans saw it too. And if you take the Gemara literally, they could have withstood the siege. They fought among themselves and burned down all the supplies and killed each other, and they created a famine. And then the Romans just came in and just finished the job. Now, the debates that raged in Yerushalayim at that time, the debates between those who said we should fight the Romans and those who said we shouldn't fight, we have to seek some kind of accommodation, are debates that have existed in the Jewish people since time immemorial. Perhaps one can find the roots of these debates already in the dispute between Yaakov Avinu and his son Shimon Velevi. When their sister was kidnapped and raped, they went ahead and killed the whole city. And Yaakov said, you can't do things like that. And they responded, Hakizona Yayasa Hotenu. Right? And one can find later examples as well. And one can find contemporary examples as well. In Israel today, we call this right and left, right? And this is what much of Israeli politics and Jewish politics around the world is dominated by. How much do we fight our enemies? How much do we seek accommodation with them? Do we seek victory, even at the cost of war? Do we seek peace, even at the cost of compromise or capitulation or whatever term you want to use? Do we... When the great world powers make demands, do we bow our heads and accept the demands of the great world powers, or do we stand up and fight them and, you know, or defy their will? These debates existed at the time of the Maccabim, these debates exist today, and they existed in the time of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai as well, and they existed afterwards. For decades later, for generations later, we see in the Talmud they continue to debate whether Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made the right decision or the wrong one. And Rabbi Akiva, at least according to one version, the champion of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, said, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was wrong. You don't capitulate to the Romans, you fight. And others said otherwise. The debate is not the problem. And the question of whether Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made the right decision or the wrong decision politically, I'm sure at the time of King Chizkiyahu, the same debate was taking place. That's not the issue. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai realized something else. It could be that my political philosophy is the right one. It could be that my political philosophy is the wrong one. You could call it a political philosophy. You could call it a religious philosophy. It could be that we're supposed to fight. It could be we're supposed to accommodate. And of course, there are numerous variations and nuances in between. But even Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda, who didn't do what I did, understands that this situation is different. Because if there's a chance of saving Yerushalayim, it's not when what's going on in there is happening. Yerushalayim is already destroyed. Yerushalayim has destroyed itself. And I can't save a city that has destroyed itself. Sinat Chinam has already destroyed Yerushalayim. And therefore, even Chizkiyahu, who has a different political philosophy than me, who, and if I could see into the future, maybe Rabbi Akiva one day, who will think I made the wrong decision, but if he was here now, he would understand. That even if you agree with that approach in principle, it can't happen. It can happen when Jews disagree, but it can't happen when Jews fight. And that's the difference. The Talmud says in Masechet Avot, Mishnah Masechet Avot, Kol machloket shehi l'shem shamayim sofa lihitkayim, v'she'ina l'shem shamayim ein sofa lihitkayim. Any argument for the sake of heaven will survive, and an argument that's not for the sake of heaven will not survive. And the Mishnah gives examples of each. Ezeli machloket shehi l'shem shamayim. What's an example of an argument for the sake of heaven? Zo machloket hilel v'shamayim. Right, the great debates among the rabbis who disagreed so strongly, the debates that we have in the Beit Midrash, where we disagree about fundamental principles of faith and practice, those are machloket l'shem shamayim. Ve'ezohi machloket she'ena l'shem shamayim. Zo machloket Korach v'adato, machloket of Korach who stood up to Moshe Rabbeinu, not for the sake of heaven, not because it was a genuine ideological disagreement, but for personal gain. That's not. That's a well-known Mishnah. But a number of years ago, actually just over a year ago, I was thinking about this Mishnah, and I realized that there's something strange about the Mishnah. It says that there's a machloket l'shem shamayim, there's a good argument, and there's a bad argument. I understand that. And it says that one of these arguments will survive and endure, and one will not. I might have expected it to be the opposite. I might have expected that the machloket l'shem shamayim, right, will ultimately be resolved. Right? That people who disagree with one another, not because they hate one another, but because they genuinely disagree and each side only wants what's best and what's true, eventually one side will see the truth of the other side and that argument will cease to end. The arguments that are driven by hatred and jealousy and greed, those arguments will never end. I might have expected that. But that's not what the Mishnah says. Korach's argument doesn't endure because Korach doesn't endure. The machloket of Hillel and Shammai continues forever. We don't shy away from disagreements. We thrive on them. Debates, argumentation, different points of view, even on the most fundamental matters are legitimate. Not only legitimate, they are good. The debates of Hillel and Shammai will continue forever. And perhaps also the political or ideological debates about how do we run our nation and our interactions with others, at least until such time comes that we have no more enemies, right? The prophets tell us of a future time when the whole world will recognize the truth of what we stand for and will submit to us. So maybe at that point the machloket will be irrelevant. But until then the arguments are always going to go on. You have people on the right and you have people on the left, and they each feel passionately and strongly that what they're doing is right, and they will work at odds to one another to try to advance their cause. That's all legitimate. That's all fine. That's not what destroyed Yerushalayim. What destroyed Yerushalayim was Sinat Chinam, was when these debates were settled with swords and with arrows and with Jews killing Jews. And I believe that's why Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai understood that at this point, all I can do is ask for Yavne v'chachameha and hope that after the destruction, I'll be able to rebuild and start from fresh because Yerushalayim is already destroyed. And it's well known, of course, that Rav Kook said that if Yerushalayim was destroyed by Sinat Chinam, it has to be built by Ahavat Chinam. And if this is the meaning of what Sinat Chinam means, then that's what it means. It doesn't mean we have to settle our differences. And it doesn't mean that one side has to convince the other that it's correct. It means we have to learn how to conduct correct debates and how we have to recognize the parameters of those debates. And each side can passionately advocate their cause and do whatever they can to bring about, right? In a democracy, that's what we do. We have elections and we have all sorts of things, but you have to know where the red lines are. We have to remember that we're one nation and that we have to make sure that the debates remain on the level of machloket l'shem shamayim and not descend to sinat chinam. And one final word, you know, we've been through a very difficult month, the Jewish people, and so many different things have happened in the last month. It was just about a month ago exactly that the three boys were kidnapped, and within a day or two, I didn't check exactly, but it's just about a month.
June
12th. June? Today's July 7th. No, it wasn't. It wasn't June 1st. Oh, June 12th. Okay, I thought you said June 1st. Right. Okay, so it's been about a month. In that month, we went through worrying and praying and mourning, and then we went through horror at the fact that some of our own people committed a murder, and next thing we knew, we were at war, and there's missiles flying, and there's all sorts of... A lot of people commented for example, at the funeral for the three boys, it was all over the internet, and a number of people spoke at the funeral that the unity that was felt in Am Yisrael is something we haven't felt in many, many years. And in a few hours after the funerals, before the next crisis blew up in our face, some people were worried that perhaps that unity was already beginning to fray. And now we're back united again, but God willing, this war will end, and we'll be once again in a situation where the debates are going to surface once again. And the question is if we can emerge from this and hold on to that unity, not by agreeing, but by understanding that we are, in fact, one nation that has to remain one nation. I hope, and I also believe, that we'll be able to do that, and that's ultimately what's going to bring about the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash.